Charles McKay recounts astounding tales of people caught up in myths, legends, phobias, witch hunts of stunning impact. Anyone who hasn't read that book, I strongly recommend it. In the preface to the book, McKay remarks that any proper treatment of this subject would actually require over 500 volumes. Again, this was in 1841, and that would not include the many religious manias that have swept the world from time to time. However, it may well be that modern man and modern woman are also not immune from such foolish fads and manias, especially when it pertains to government and politics. As the great journalist and author H.L. Mencken stated, quote, "The whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary," unquote. This past year, of course, we've seen a war in Iraq, and much of the populace today is beginning to wonder whether the claims of public officials were what they actually were. The American public, of course, is religiously believed in what government officials have said in many fronts. Since 9/11, the federal government has grown by some estimate 25%, depends on whether you add the new $87 billion for the cost of Iraq in or not. It can be as high as 30.5% for non-defense discretionary spending. Certainly the sayings of the past that truth is the first casualty of war and that war is the health of the state certainly have proved out over the last few years. When John Stossel joined ABC's 2020 in 1981, his peers and an admiring public hailed him as a crusading consumer reporter. His hard-hitting exposés of con artists, corporate liars, and crooks won him 19 Emmys and an avid following. But along the way, he began wondering whether he was missing a far bigger story of scandal, intrigue, and foolishness. While so many reporters were focusing on threats from business fraud and championing expanding government power as the solution, John began asking whether such power and the nanny state itself might be one of the biggest scams of all. People ranging from William Bennett to Ralph Nader have pleaded for years for ever-growing government power to be able to solve problems as if the police power was somehow objective, saintly, and enlightened. The result, of course, is a staggering array of government waste and incompetence, systematic fraud, welfare for the rich, victimless crimes, but that's what John is going to be talking about tonight. In his book, Give Me a Break, which as of this morning was number 2 on the Amazon list, and hopefully will be number 1 shortly, and really in the fine tradition of Charles McKay, John is taking on a herd of sacred cows and examining whether in the public interest, politicians and bureaucrats, reporters, scaremongers of all different types across the spectrum, special interests, predatory lawyers, and so on, actually are contributing to modern phobias, myths, and legends. And the question is, who really is benefiting from all this? Our speaker this evening, of course, is well known as the co-host of ABC's 2020 and the top-rated John Stossel specials, which many of you, I hope, have seen. They're available if you haven't. John's also been honored 5 times for excellence in consumer reporting by the National Press Club, and he's a recipient of the George Polk Award and the George Foster Peabody Award. Please join me in welcoming John Stossel.
Now, I'm shorter than he, so I talk right in the mic. Is that easier to hear? Now, should I announce to the people outside that there are chairs in here? There are chairs in here. There are about 10 or 11 chairs in here if somebody wants to come in. Go to the middle aisle and go back. And still three left. Four left. Two left. Huh? Two left, yes. Two more. Do you want to come in? Three left. Sorry, they keep appearing. They're growing. Chairs are growing like government. Yeah, somebody has two fingers up over there, so there are two more. Go right in. So, I'm a libertarian, and I find libertarians hate the subtitle to this book. I'm not crazy about it myself, but I trust that my publisher, being smarter than I in book marketing, knows what they're doing. How I exposed hucksters, cheats, and scam artists and became the scourge of the liberal media. Libertarians tend to hate it because the implication is that this is another one of those conservative books. And that, in fact, I think the book editor couldn't tell the difference. And they think conservative books sell. But it's also interesting because there are some books out now by people of the left who talk about how there's no liberal media. And they are quite serious. And one of the examples they give is, look at it, ABC, they have these conservatives, George Will and John Stossel. And Stossel isn't even described as a columnist. He does regular reporting and anchoring, too. How terrible. And they do consider me a conservative. Now, I happen to think that homosexuality is perfectly natural. I think the drug war is a mistake, that prostitution should be legal, that you ought to be able to burn a flag if you want to, that some abortion should be legal. I'm against going into Iraq, and they call me a conservative. This says more about the mainstream culture than about me. Why do they call me real conservatives should be insulted. And they probably are. Why do they call me conservative? Because I like free markets? What's conservative about free markets? They're unplanned, chaotic. And yet they call us conservatives because we think free markets are wonderful things. What's this about? I still can't come to terms with it. I try in this book a little bit. But capitalism is just hated in newsrooms that I've been in, and in the academy. What is this about? People hate their employers, and their employers pay them. People like the government, and the government takes a third of their money and squanders it. What is it about commerce that brings out this anger? I'm not sure. But I started 33 years ago as a consumer reporter, and I shared many of these young reporters' feelings. I was out there to bang on business, and I did night after night. I did stories criticizing the Coffee Institute. It was running ads that said, coffee is the drink that picks you up while it calms you down. What? Exactly. So I called them up and said, how can you say this? It's contradictory. They said, we have research to back this up. Really, what's the research? Well, we surveyed thousands of people. We asked them, what do you get out of your coffee break? Some people said it picked them up. Some people said it calmed them down. I reported on the solar-powered clothes dryer for just $50, they advertised. We sent in our $50 and we got back a clothesline. It was very clever. And there were lots of scams like that, and that's why we consumer activists said, we've got to protect people. How are we going to do it? We need regulation. You need the Federal Trade Commission to get involved. You need attorneys general on the case and lawyers suing. And then I watched them work, and I'm a little ashamed at how long it took me to see the folly of this regulation, how it piled on paperwork It enriched lawyers. It helps bureaucrats build little empires that took away our freedom, made us fill out more forms. David tried to get me to sign some form today about permission for taping. I guess that was short and that was more reasonable. But it didn't affect the crooks. The people selling the penis enlargers and the breast enlargers were still doing it, getting away with it. The government was too incompetent to put even the obvious crooks out of business. Instead, they just passed more rules that burdened everybody else. The more I watched the market work, the more puzzled I was that it seemed to protect us even in areas where I wouldn't intuitively think the market would. For example, look at the greedy companies that have employed me. I've worked for all three of the biggest networks, and they get all their money from the advertisers, and yet they paid me to be a consumer reporter, to bite the hand that fed them. Why? Ralph Nader, when consumer reporting began, said this would never happen. He said you'll see consumer reporting only on public television because the commercial stations won't want to offend their sponsors. 30 years later, what's happened? The opposite is true, as is the case with a lot of what Ralph says. There is no consumer reporting on PBS, the timid bureaucrats who run it are too nervous about offending anybody. But there are consumer reporters on most commercial TV stations because the market rewards consumers. In this case, what happened is, yes, some advertisers got ticked off at what I did and pulled out big accounts. Bristol Myers, which makes Buffer and Excedrin, sued me and CBS when I said they were lying in their advertising for $25 million. You'd think CBS would have said, Stossel ain't worth that. But they didn't. They just said, look, we'll fight this, we'll get it thrown out, and go ahead, do your consumer reporting. Why? Because the market protected us. More of you, it turned out, wanted to watch a news program that did consumer reporting. And so, yes, they lost some ads, but they made more money because they had higher ratings. The market just works miracles constantly, but we take them for granted. The market protects us in unexpected ways. Now, when I say this, people say, well, that's trivial. When it comes to the serious stuff, whether we're safe, then you got to have the regulation. Got to have OSHA and the CPSC and the whole alphabet soup of agencies we have in Sacramento and Washington, D.C. And intuitively, this does make sense. We're scared. New things are happening. Mysterious chemicals are being used. And we want Big Nanny with the wise scientists who work in Sacramento to make the decisions for us. It's instinct. But as I watched it happen, I saw it go awry because the regulations, by interfering with the wishes of millions of free people, the market, always creates nasty side effects, and they're worse. Let's look at it in the area, just as a thought experiment, in the area of drugs, legal and illegal. Illegal first. I have two teenage kids. Intuitively, again, I'm pleased that heroin and cocaine, ecstasy are illegal. They can't zip down to the neighborhood pharmacy and go get high. But does that really deter them? It's not like the drug laws are keeping the stuff out of the country. We can't even keep it out of prisons. How do we think we're keeping it out of the country? There's the forbidden fruit effect. Maybe the kids are more attracted to it because it's illegal. The kids say it's as easy to get as alcohol. So I question, what does the law accomplish? Maybe a certain percentage of us will try intoxicants, and maybe a certain percentage will abuse them independent of what the law is. I don't know. But I do now know the downside of the law, because now I can see that. And it's awful. There are four things. First and worst is the crime. I mean, almost nobody gets high on these drugs and goes out and commits crimes because they're high. The crime happens because it's illegal, because the gangs can't rely on police protection for their private property, so they form gangs and arm themselves. The buyers have to choose to steal to pay the high prices. Nicotine and alcohol, according to the government, are roughly equally addictive. Nicotine and heroin. Yet no one's knocking over 7-Elevens to get Marlboros. It's the law that causes all this violent crime. Secondly, we're corrupting police forces. We're asking cops who make $25,000 a year to turn down $25,000 bribes. Not all do. We're corrupting the economy of the ghetto. We're asking kids in poor neighborhoods to take entry-level jobs at McDonald's. Why should I, says the kid? My little brother can make more as a drug lookout. And the role models, the people with the best cars and the best clothes, are the criminals. What a bad message we're sending the kids. And finally, we're building unbelievably rich criminal gangs. It's the drug trade that partially funded Osama bin Laden. Now we're destroying Colombia, and soon, I mean, Al Capone was created by alcohol prohibition. The gangs we're creating now will soon be able to buy nuclear weapons. So why are we doing this? Well, to protect us from ourselves. But if that's a good thing to do in a free society, then there is no end to what the government can do. Soon maybe they'll have exercise police coming into our homes and making us run laps and do push-ups. Let's go on to legal drugs. Here too, intuitively it made sense. I don't want some company to poison me, some snake oil seller to tell me he can cure my back pain and sell me something that'll get me killed or addict me to something. Thank God the government, Big Nanny, is going to protect me. And the government protected us from thalidomide. This is what was the big success story of the FDA, and since then they've grown in size 10 times. Thalidomide was a tranquilizer women took during some women took during pregnancy and gave birth to children with severe birth defects. So I'm glad they protected us from thalidomide. But is it worth it? I don't think so anymore. Because now it takes 12 to 15 years to get a new drug approved. What this means is there are good things that we could have that might save us that we can't have because of government. Some years ago they announced proudly, this new beta blocker we're approving, this new heart drug will save 14,000 American lives a year. And no one stood up at the news conference to say, excuse me, didn't that mean you killed 14,000 people last year? But it did mean that. We just don't think that way. We don't think of what innovation, what regulation deprives us of. It's easy to put the thalidomide baby on the cover of Life magazine, as we did. But who would be saved by the new drug? I don't know which one of you to picture. Right now in this 15-year pipeline, there are fat substitutes, stuff that would let us eat all the ice cream and cake we want and not get fat. Now, there's a tiny chance there's something bad in there, and they want to make sure. But 5,000 people die in this country from obesity every year. Don't they count in the equation? Eat? No, they don't count, because we don't know who you are. Now, when I say this to less informed groups, people say, well, it just sounds too scary. What are you saying, Stossel? Not have an FDA? These creeps would poison us, these greedy businesses. First of all, I don't think companies like killing their customers. But even assuming they did, why in a free society do we meekly sit there and allow the government to be a police agency that says, no, you are forbidden? Why couldn't it be an information agency? Those of us who, the companies that wanted to submit their drug to the arduous process would, and those of us who are cautious would only take those FDA-approved drugs. But if you were dying, if you had a terminal illness, you could try something without having to break your country's laws and import something illegally from Europe or sneak to some dubious clinic in Mexico. And what we would learn from those trials would save other lives later. I'd go further and say that you really don't need the government to even be the information agency, because as we should have learned from the fall of the Soviet Union, government agencies don't do things well. And if you simply eliminated the FDA, the private groups that government has crowded out would step in and do the job better, quicker, faster, cheaper. Quicker and faster is the same. I have to work on that. I don't know who these groups would be. It's a fatal conceit to predict how the market will work, but maybe Underwriters Laboratories would do it, or Consumer Reports. But I bet they'd do it better than the government. And in any case, isn't leaving us a choice what America's supposed to be about? Patrick Henry didn't say, give me safety, give me He didn't say give me absolute safety or give me death. It's supposed to be about freedom. Let's go on to the other layer of safety protection in America, and that's the trial lawyers. Now, I don't like them either, and we laugh about them, but we should like them if we are believers in free markets, because they are a free market solution. Unlike clumsy one-size-fits-all government regulation, the trial lawyer is a supplement to Adam Smith's invisible hand. It's the invisible fist. The private lawsuit. You behave badly and we will come and crush you. But the lawyers have gamed the system so it serves only them. And what a horrible system it is now, because they proudly say we get compensation for victims. But what kind of compensation system is this when it takes 15, 20 years sometimes for the victim to get their money? And the people who are often injured don't sue, and the people who collect are often the people who are not victims of malpractice or really injured. And when most of the money goes to the lawyers, not to the victims. Now, you may say, what do you mean most of the money goes to the lawyers? The plaintiff's lawyers only take 30 or 40%. But if you take that 30, 40% and then add in the court costs and the defense lawyer costs, most of the money is going to the process. This is nuts. 70% to the lawyers? What kind of compensation system is this? Then they say, well, look, at least we deter bad behavior. Some company is going to think twice about making a dangerous product. And there is some truth to that. There is a role for lawsuits in America. We need lawyers. But we also need nuclear missiles to keep us safe. But we try to avoid using nuclear missiles because they cause a lot of collateral damage. So do lawsuits. And we ought to avoid using them because they cause huge damage. They are taking huge amounts of our freedom and our money. The least of it is actually the money, the cost of things. The lawyers attack the people who stand on the edge of life and death, who are best at protecting us and keeping us alive. For example, pacemakers cost $3,000 more just to pay for the lawsuits. They attack the paramedics, the hospitals, the drug device makers, the drug makers. But the cost is the least of it. The worst of it is all the good things we don't even get to have. Because out of fear of lawsuits, people don't dare try things. Some years ago, they sued the vaccine makers, claiming the DPT vaccine was not as safe as it could have been. I suspect junk science. But let's say they were right, and let's say their suit saved a dozen lives a year. I don't think it's worth it anymore. Because when they sued, 20 companies were researching and making vaccines in America. Now there are four. Are we safer in an age of bioterrorism where with four vaccine makers rather than 20? No way. They kill the people we need most. Now they also kill the information flow. And we need good information so we can make good decisions to protect ourselves. We ought to read labels, for example. Read the label on the antibiotic that tells you don't take tetracycline with milk. Won't work if you do. But who reads labels anymore? There are 41 warnings on a stepladder. Out of fear of lawsuits, they just smear them everywhere and nobody reads them. Or have you ever looked at the label on a birth control pill? I happen to bring one here. Look at this thing. Tiny fine print, both sides of the page. It's so much, it doesn't make us safer. Even the doctor doesn't read it. And if you read it, you wouldn't need the pill anymore. I was gradually learning that we can protect ourselves better than the lawyers or government can or will. Now, I'm not arguing I'm not an anarchist. I don't think the market will take care of everything. I think we need government. I think the worst places to live in Africa, parts of South America, well, Africa mostly, are the places that don't have enough government, where you can't be certain that your private property will stay yours, that you'll be protected, kept safe. Nobody builds a factory if they don't think they can keep it. So we need some government to keep the peace, to guard the borders, and I would argue further, to protect the environment, because there's often no market incentive to behave well. My smoke goes to your yard, your lungs. What do I care? We need pollution law. But how much of this government do we need? For most of the history of America, government was less than 5% of GDP. America did very well then. We grew fast. We accommodated millions of immigrants. So how big should government be? Do the politicians ever ask this question? No. They just want more. But how big is government? Should it be 6% of the economy? 8, 10%? What nobody realizes is that it's approaching 40% now and still growing. President Clinton received thunderous applause in Congress from Republicans and Democrats when he said the era of big government's over. But since then, they added 600,000 pages to the Federal Register, another spider web of little rules to take away our freedom. Government today runs trains, subways, parks, public housing, a war on drugs, and a welfare state. It subsidizes everybody. Students, farmers, Indians, researchers, volunteers, small businessmen, rich businessmen. Maybe if it weren't doing all that stuff badly, it could focus on what it should do, which is keep us safe and not issue visas to the World Trade Center terrorists 2 months after they were blown up in the World Trade Center. Well, I started reporting such things and saying such things gradually into my career as I read libertarian literature and started to realize there was another way to think about things. I'd like to say I read what the Independent Institute produces, but that's this peer-reviewed intellectual stuff was over my head. I read Reason magazine. And I was impressed. Wow, these guys understand this better than I do, and they have really thought about it. It was very exciting, and I started reporting on government and public interest, so-called public interest activist groups and lawyers instead of just business. And suddenly, I was no longer a good reporter. I won 18 Emmy Awards before I went to the dark side as the TV writer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch actually said, "When did you go to the dark side?" Now I no longer win awards for my peers. Somehow my skill as a reporter has just disappeared. Some of my ABC colleagues, when they see me in the hall, they go, that was a quick turn away for those of you in the other room. CNN, after I did my first special, Are We Scaring Ourselves to Death, invited me to be on a journalism show, and I showed up, and I saw the title of the program was Objectivity and Journalism. Does John Stossel practice either? Their argument was that I was not objective because I was taking a point of view in these stories, and I admit it, I do. But I always had. I'd never gone to journalism school. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I learned through fear. I landed in this job in Portland, Oregon, and as a researcher in a TV newsroom, and I just tried to figure out what should people know and how can I tell it to them in an interesting way. My mother said, "You better work harder, you'll freeze in the dark," and I worked hard. But I always took a position. I was doing research on products, and I would say, "We've looked into this, and this product sucks." So now I'm saying, "I've looked into this, and this government program sucks." But suddenly now I'm a problem. Howard Kurtz, the media writer for the Washington Post, wrote an article about me then, and he titled it, "The Jaded Crusader." He quoted Sidney Wolfe of Public Citizen saying Stossel was a menace doing a massive amount of damage. And Ralph Nader saying Stossel used to be on the cutting edge, but now he's the most dishonest journalist I've ever encountered. He talked about my leap from consumer advocate to friend of industry. But why am I a friend of industry? Industry doesn't like free markets either. Industry half the time tries to game the system to screw their competitors. They want to partner with government to hurt their competitors. They're not necessarily friends of free markets. And also, I'm no longer a consumer advocate if I'm reporting on government. Doesn't government screw consumers too? You bet.
So where does this attitude come from among my peers, this leftist thinking? I'm not sure, but it is just the culture that I live in. I live in Manhattan. Well, many of you live in San Francisco, very similar environment. And it's just out there. More safety regulation? Who doesn't want that? Higher taxes to pay for the welfare state? Everybody wants that. More gun control? Of course. Got to reduce gun violence. It's just the way people think. And anyone who doesn't think that way is viewed as selfish and cruel. And if I try to ask my peers about bias, they just look at me blankly. Bias? It's like asking a fish about water. What water? I think some of this attitude where I live comes from the New York Times. Now, clearly the Chronicle is influential and other papers, but the Times is hugely influential. It shouldn't be, because it has a tiny circulation, 1 million and falling. Compare that to the networks, 33 million people. But the Times matters because the other media copy it, sycophantically. When I was a local reporter in New York City, the assignment editor would just take the Times and tear things out and say, here, go do this. If you look at the network TV shows, they're often just an evening TV version of the New York Times. Beyond the million circulation, if you think the absurdity of their power, page A16 is read, I bet, every day, maybe by 10,000 people. And yet, because it's copied, it's influential. In August of the year 2000, the Times put a picture of the North Pole on the cover and said, the North Pole is melting! The thick ice that for ages covered the Arctic Ocean at the poles turned to water, something that presumably never before has been seen by humans, and is evidence that global warming may be real and already affecting climate. 10 days later, the Times apologized, saying it misstated the normal conditions of the sea ice, and about 10% of the Arctic Ocean is clear of ice every summer. But by then, it had been copied by the Washington Post, USA Today, the AP, National Public Radio, of course, TV networks, Canadian TV, and newspapers in London. Many used in their articles the exact same global warming expert the Times used. Now, it's not that there's a conspiracy to sell, we're going to sell the public on global warming. It's just the groupthink that the media live in, the mainstream media. Even basic free market principles are doubted, if not mocked. I'm trying to remember the name of the person who wanted me to address this today. Is it Gabriel? Or I can't remember. Anyway, one of my worst battles with ABC Legal Review was over a Give Me a Break segment I did on rent control. Now, even the New York Times editorial page editorializes against rent control. I mean, even they get it. And, of course, no economist thinks it's a good idea. My story, I thought, was fairly simple. I talked about how Mia Farrow and Carly Simon and Alistair Cook have these grand apartments they paid 7 cents for, while everybody else had to pay a fortune or couldn't find anything because the market had stagnated because of rent control. And I interviewed Walter Williams, who said, short of aerial bombardment, the best way to destroy a city is through rent control. But this economically illiterate ABC lawyer kept blocking the story, kept saying, this can't be right. You have to soften it. You have to interview other economists. This would kill the poor if rent control were abolished. I later learned he lived in a rent control apartment. But anyway, I plunge ahead, and ABC, God bless them, let me write this book and lets me do against conventional wisdom stories on television. And last Friday, I did one called 10 Myths, 10 Lies, Myths, and Stupidity. Number 6 was Republicans Shrink Government. Number 5 was Rich People Don't Pay Their Fair Share of the Income Tax. For that one, I invited in the Democratic presidential candidates to talk about it. The first one to show up and agree to talk about it was Reverend Al Sharpton. I wanted to ask them because I had a hunch that they didn't even know what rich people paid when they were complaining the rich didn't pay their fair share. So I said to Al, what should they pay? And he said 15%. Isn't that good? I said, the top 1%, they should pay 50. He said, yes. And they don't pay 10% now. They don't pay 5%. And I said, but Al, they now pay 34%. The top 1% pay 34% of the income tax. And he's brilliant. He just changed the subject without it seeming like he was changing the subject. So I'm not going to fall for that. I asked him again about 18 times, and 18 times he slimed away perfectly. But there were some good moments in there. Myth number 3 was that guns are evil and that gun control will reduce violent crime. So we talked about how the CDC hasn't found that it has, and again I had fun with the Reverend by saying, what if we had a law that said anybody over 21 could carry a pistol on their person, hidden? And he said, oh my God, there'd be carnage. It would be a reign of terror. Because he had no clue that 36 states already have right to carry laws. Nobody where I live. I bet many of you don't know that 36 states, it's legal, and there's no more violent crime in those states because the surveys show that what prisoners fear most is not the cops. Now, what felons fear most is not the cops, not prison. It's that the woman they're about to mug is packing. So those are some of the myths we covered, and the show did very well and launched my book, unfortunately has now fallen to number 3 on the nonfiction list, but it's early, it's the first week. The good news is that it will be number 10 on the New York Times bestseller list, and the Times is so late with this, in 2 weeks, but that represents what happened the first week, and the first week was only a half week, so the publisher is all excited about that, and I have to get it on the bestseller list, number 1, ahead of Al Franken. Or I'm going to be very upset. So I'm delighted to sign your books, and I hope you get more than one and give them to all your friends. So if you buy them at a bookstore, please do more than 5 at a time, because otherwise it doesn't count toward the list. No, it's how they try to eliminate people like David from manipulating the list by buying 300 books. The reason I wrote the book is that I'm upset that we know what works. Limited government and market capitalism that has lifted people out of the mud and misery. It created wonderful places like America, Hong Kong. We know what works, yet 4 billion people on Earth continue to live on a dollar or two a day. And in the academy and in newsrooms, this system that could lift them out is vilified. This is wrong. I thank you for fighting for the liberty that makes people's lives better. Thank you very much.